Listening at home, we're again back for the last segment of our proceedings this afternoon. Dr. Pozhan is still in the witness stand. Let me mention a couple things before we start with Ms. Renzi's questions here. First, that we thought it would be a good idea, given we have two witnesses scheduled for tomorrow, and that we would get some of Dr. Pozhan's cross in today. If you have a logical breaking point at some point before 6 o'clock, I think we don't want to go past 6 o'clock today. If you have a logical breaking point at some point prior to that, Ms. Renzi, let us know. Maybe we'll stop at that point. The other point being, just to say for the record that we did, as Mr. Matanowski mentioned earlier, we did have a conference at the bench earlier today, and as he alluded to, there is, at that point, there was raised a motion that was filed in the King case and perhaps in the Meade case too, but it's relevant to both. It was filed on Friday afternoon electronically, having to do with a reference to a number of medical articles, over 200 medical articles that were filed last week that were new to the case, filed by the petitioners, cited by them, that were not previously discussed in expert reports of either side, and raising that issue as the issue of what to do about that, and asking to that the petitioners be prevented from making reference to these articles in their own expert direct examination. The representation had been last week at a status conference that the purpose of filing these articles was to make them available for cross-examination of the respondents' experts. And Mr. Matanowski did mention that he was some of those articles had been raised today in the examination of Dr. Pozhan and perhaps and Dr. Greenland as well, in the direct examination of him, and that the government would be was considering filing an additional motion seeking additional relief here. Again, we note that we'll hear that motion whenever you want to present it or you can file it in writing. We'll wait to hear exactly what you have in mind. But obviously a couple of our questions to Dr. Pozhan were addressed to that issue. Having so you know, we'll wait to what the government proposes to do about that issue explicitly at this point. With that, Ms. Renzi, if you, whatever questions you had for Dr. Pozhan this afternoon, go ahead and go for it at this point.
Thank you, Special Master. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Pozhan, you said you were currently a professor at the University of Arizona?
I'm Professor Emeritus. I retired on January 31st to take care of my wife and other people in my family. But I still have an active laboratory with funding for research for 2 more years.
Do you know if you're listed on the University of Arizona website as a faculty member or a professor emeritus?
Excuse me?
Do you know if you are listed on the University of Arizona's website as either a member of the faculty or as a faculty?
I don't have the faintest idea. I don't read that sort of stuff, but I do have letters that I can send you from the president of the university and from the medical school people saying that I have emeritus status.
Do you know
if you never dare say anything that was not so?
Okay. Are you listed as a professor at the Pharmacology School of Medicine? Do you know that? Do you have emeritus status there as well?
For the last 32 years, I've been listed in the catalog of the medical school as professor of pharmacology.
Do you know who Glenn Sipes is? The chair of the pharmacology department at the University of Arizona.
Excuse me?
Glenn Sipes. Do you know Glenn Sipes?
Yeah, I know Glenn Sipes very well.
Is he a well-respected toxicologist?
Of course he's a well-respected toxicologist.
And do you know a man, John Sullivan, at the University of Arizona?
I don't know him personally. I know of his reputation. He's a very good clinical toxicologist. Some people use the term medical toxicologist, but I think the board, and again, you can correct me, I think the board uses the term clinical toxicologist. Hmm? No, it did change then. Okay. Because two of the members at the University of Colorado spent time in my laboratory, and one of them took time off to study for her board exams in clinical toxicology.
Now, you're not a medical doctor, is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
And you're not a medical toxicologist, is that correct?
It depends on how you define the term medical toxicologist. I've brought in by the Chinese government, I was brought in by the Chilean government. I was brought in by the Inner Mongolia government as a pro bono consultant to deal with a population of people who were drinking arsenic with elevated levels, drinking water with elevated levels of arsenic.
But you don't
and,
have.
Excuse me. Let me continue.
Okay.
And so I took a team with me, and I was the person responsible for everything. I was a person that wrote up the reports. I dealt with humans. Now, am I a medical toxicologist? I don't like the term. I'm a toxicologist.
Wait, you don't have a medical degree to...
I have no medical degrees, as I've told you before.
That means you're also not a neurologist, is that correct?
Pardon?
You're not a neurologist.
Obviously, I can't be a neurologist if I don't have an MD.
Do you consider yourself qualified to comment on the neurological aspects of autism?
It all depends on what parts of the neurological aspects you're talking about, but I would certainly give it, I would certainly take second place. I would prefer that a medical neurologist answered such questions.
Are you an immunologist?
I'm not an immunologist.
Do you consider yourself qualified to opine on the immunology as it relates to autism?
Again, it depends on what level you're speaking of. If you want me to go into the very fine levels of immunology as far as applying to humans, I certainly not want to speak that way. I'm a basic science bench investigator. I work at the lab bench. And I go study populations of people at the invitation of governments throughout the world.
Have you ever published a peer-reviewed article on mercury in the immune system?
No, I have not.
Have you ever published a peer-reviewed article on autism?
We are now in the process of writing a review article that's been we've been asked to write by an international journal as a toxicologist's view of autism. I expect the article will be finished sometime this summer. That was an invitation. That was an article. We did not ask to do it. They invited us to do it. Invitation.
Have you ever published a peer-reviewed article on thimerosal toxicity?
I don't remember whether some of our abstracts... I would say no.
Have you ever published a peer-reviewed article on ethyl mercury toxicity?
On what?
Ethyl mercury toxicity.
Not published, but we've given many talks at symposium. The Institute of Medicine invited me. I actually did not want to go. They invited me, I think it was 2004, I think it was, to speak at one of their vaccine committee meetings on, quote, a toxicologist's view of autism and thimerosal.
Do you consider yourself an expert in autism?
I consider myself an expert on the relationship of mercury to autism.
And when did you acquire that expertise?
When?
Yes.
Oh, fine. I love to tell you this. Love to tell you this story. In 2002 or 2003, I had a call from the administrative assistant to Congressman Burton of the House Government Oversight and Regulation Committee, I think it's called that. And at that time, the administrative assistant, she actually asked me whether I would come and talk to the committee on mercury toxicity. And I said, certainly, but why are you interested in mercury toxicity? This is probably 5 years ago, I would say. And they said, well, we're really interested in autism, and there's mercury involved. And I said, okay. And I went home and decided I really didn't know what autism was. So I have two daughters who have PhDs in clinical psychology. And I called them and I said, what is autism? And they, in fact, were delighted to know something that their father did not know. And so I first learned about autism at that time. And since then, there have been many organizations like the Institutes of Medicine and other organizations that wanted someone who had more or less a fresh view of autism that was not part of any establishment as far as autism is concerned. And so in the last 5 years, I've become very interested in autism.
Are you aware of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, otherwise known as the DSM-4?
I'm aware of it.
What are the criterion for an autism diagnosis?
Oh, I would certainly open up the book and read it.
You don't know them.
There are regulations that I don't know. So that's some of them. I can talk about other regulations I don't know either. If something's something that you can find on the web or in a book, there's no sense of memorizing, especially since you don't use it every day. What we were concerned about was that all of our autistic subjects in our urine studies were classified by a physician by the usual standards that you've just mentioned and the other standards for autism.
You've published several articles on chelation, is that correct?
I would say many people think my major contribution from the last 1979, have dealt with chelation.
Would you agree that you're not qualified to diagnose or treat a person with ethylmercury toxicity?
I have never claimed I have been.
Would you agree that you're not qualified to diagnose or treat a person with any form of mercury toxicity?
It all depends now on how you want to define diagnosis. If, as very often, a physician will call me and say, Vass, we have this case here, and the urine mercuries are this much, and the blood mercuries are such and such, or we've done a biopsy, as a case just happened now, of someone's gut, and we want to know whether you think it's worth doing a mercury analysis or you think this person may have mercury toxicity. What I usually say, as they well know, is, John, Joe, whatever your name is, I'm not a physician, as you know, but based on what you've told me, it seems to me that that person is mercury toxic. But would I stand up in a court of law and say, hey, I'm an expert in diagnosing humans? No, I would not. Because if you're going to deal with humans on a diagnostic and treatment basis, not a research basis, but a diagnostic and treatment basis, then you should be an MD.
I want to move on to dose. You've quoted today from Kasserit and Duell, the book on toxicology, correct?
Yes.
Would you agree with the statement that's in that book, that no other metal better illustrates the diversity of effects caused by different chemical species than does mercury?
Are you asking me whether I agree with this?
Yes.
I have no disagreement with it.
Would you agree that different species of mercury have different toxicological properties?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Do different species of mercury have different toxicological properties?
That was, I think, quite apparent from the talk I gave, or my testimony earlier.
Could you please define dose for me? Dose, what is dose?
Dose means different things to different people. If you're a scientist and are concerned about dose, then you want a quantitative value that tells you how much you are given to a certain animal or human being. You want a quantitative value. And that quantitative value could be milligrams or grams. It could be milligrams per kilogram. It depends on who is prescribing. And I don't prescribe to humans, of course.
Would you agree that any substance is toxic, could be toxic, to humans based upon a dose?
The point I've tried to make in the testimony is that dose is not the only criterion for toxicity, that many other criteria come into play when you discuss toxicity. And that was shown in at least two or three of my slides from the textbook that you have just quoted.
What is the principle of dose response?
Dose response usually means, not all the time, that as you increase the dose, you increase the response. Or as you decrease the dose, you decrease the response. Usually in a fairly straight line. But as we know, especially in the case of arsenic toxicity, that when you get down in lower levels, it does not, it goes off the straight line.
Is it still your opinion that the principle that dose makes the poison is no longer accepted by the general toxicological community?
That's not what I said. It is one of the factors that determine toxicity, but it's not for anyone to get up and say dose determines the poison. It's a very limited way of looking at toxicology, a very limited way of looking at a poison. There are many factors in that very chapter that you quoted with Gloria, which I presented earlier, and you have copies of various other things that affect the toxicity. It's not only dose that affects toxicity.
So that principle is no longer accepted by the general toxicological community?
I don't consider it a principle. It's something that a man in 1400 to 1500 said. And anyone who thinks that toxicology has not progressed enough to change and have a different view about someone's statement in the year 1490, whatever it is, I think has a very limited outlook on medicine and science. Most of the people that I know, Sipes included, would say dose is one of the factors that determine toxicity or determine poison. It's not the only factor.
Would you agree that in toxicology, a threshold dose is expected before a particular outcome is observed?
Before us?
That you would have a threshold dose before a particular outcome is observed.
I don't know what kind of generalization you're trying to make. I certainly know that dose, that response is related to dose. But dose is not the only thing that determines response. Is that clear?
We'll move on. How much ethyl mercury is there in a thimerosal-containing vaccine? How much ethyl mercury is there in a thimerosal-containing vaccine?
It depends on which vaccine it is. I think in one case, I can't remember which vaccine, it's 12.5 micrograms, if I remember correctly. In the other case of a vaccine, it's 25 micrograms.
And I know you had this on your slide presentation earlier. How many micrograms are there in a milligram?
There are a million micrograms in a milligram. I'm sorry. There are 1,000 micrograms in a milligram. Isn't that what it said?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And how many micrograms are there in a gram?
There should be a million micrograms in a gram.
Now, Dr. Poshian, is it scientifically valid to compare the doses of ethyl mercury that are in a thimerosal-containing vaccine, and I'll use TVC from now on if that's okay, in a TVC... Is it right to compare those
doses? I don't
doses?
Like the term TBC. Would you please? I don't like abbreviations. Would you mind saying the whole thing? We have computers now that can print things out very carefully, and I think it's much clearer if we don't use abbreviations, if you don't mind.
If you would like me to say it, that would be fine.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
I'll repeat the question then. Is it scientifically valid to compare doses of ethyl mercury that are contained in a thimerosal-containing vaccine to the exposures of methylmercury that occurred in Iraq and Minamata?
It all depends on what you mean by compare. If you're saying, do you want to see if each of them is toxic? Yes. If you want to say, is one more toxic than the other? I'm not sure you can do that. So I'd like to ask that you ask me, if possible, a more specific question.
Can you compare the 12.5 micrograms that are contained in a thimerosal-containing vaccine to the doses that were exposed to the people who ate the grain in Iraq and who consumed the fish in Minnesota.
I now understand your question. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. My apologies.
No, that's my question.
Okay. There is no comparison. The amount that was used, the exposure in Iraq was much, much higher. And we were talking in the talk that I gave earlier, and I think it's the Rooney paper, explained the differences between a chronic high dose and a chronic low dose. And certainly, if you want to talk about chronic doses, the exposure of children getting vaccines would be considered to be a chronic low dose, whereas the Iraqi people being exposed to the various forms of mercury in the flour that the U.S. government gave them, that would be considered a chronic high dose.
And do you agree that the researchers in Iraq and Minamata established a dose-response relationship in their studies?
I've got to be very careful here because the Minamata studies are so old. My guess is yes, they did, but I just don't remember the particular paper with the particular dosage. But I'm sure Tom Clarkson, knowing how he works, did establish a dose-response curve in Iraq.
Have you read the 1973 Bakir article, B-A-K-I-R?
Which one? I've read all the Iraqi articles, and some of the names I have difficulty remembering. Was that the one? There was one, maybe I'm not sure whether Clarkson was the first author or he was, which showed that D-penicillamine was one of the best ways of getting rid of mercury in the blood. Is that the article you're talking about?
I'm talking about an article that was filed on Petitioner's Master List 178. We can hand you that article if you'd like to see
yes,
it.
Yes, I would like to see that article, please. Yeah. Oh, this is a very old article.
Get a copy for that.
It's on your master list. You should have it.
I'm not sure I remember reading everything about it because I do remember that when it came out, I read it, and maybe a couple of times since then, but not recently. So what would you like me to address in this article?
Do you recall the threshold dose of mercury that was observed in Iraq before toxicity, before effects of toxicity were observed?
I don't recall at all.
I want to refer you then to page 238 of that article.
Page 238. 214, 234. 238.
Okay, and I think it's the top center column. Oh, and we have it up on the screen as well.
You're talking about figure 7?
I'm talking about the paragraph that's highlighted. It should be on your screen, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it says, nevertheless, the threshold value of 25 to 40 milligrams of mercury is computed for paresthesias, agree remarkably well with the threshold figure of 30 milligrams of mercury computed by the Swedish expert committee from data on the Japanese epidemics. Would you agree then from that article that the threshold value of 25 milligrams, that there is a threshold value of 25 milligrams of methylmercury?
I agree that nevertheless the threshold value of 25 milligrams of mercury was computed for paresthesia, agrees remarkably well with a figure of 30. Is that what you're asking
yes.
me? I have
now,
no argument.
The threshold value of 25 milligrams.
Yes.
What is that equal to in micrograms?
25 milligrams would be 25,000 micrograms.
In either one of those epidemics, either in Minamata or in Iraq, was there an increase of autism reported as an outcome of the affected populations?
No one even thought of autism in those days. You should ask Tom Clarkson, who is a fantastically good scientist, and people have asked him that, and his answer is no one thought about autism in those days. No one even, I think most people did not know what autism is. I think most medical students were not taught anything about autism. So it's not surprising that no autism cases turned out.
Do you know if the clinical effects, then, that were reported in either the Iraq or Minamata study resembled autism, even if we didn't know what autism was? Were any of the listed effects clinically significant for the diagnosis of autism?
Well, they certainly had, as I remember, and again, it's been a long time since I looked at these studies, but as I remember, there are cerebral palsy-like effects that they found. And you might know, you've read the article more recently than I have. That's one of, there are certainly, without any question, central nervous effects on young children and children that were born.
Do these clinical effects resemble autism?
Since I wasn't there and did not examine the children or wasn't there when a physician examined them, I just don't feel comfortable answering that question one way or the other. I would be guessing at it.
Could you clarify your opinion as it relates to the thimerosal-containing vaccines we're discussing today? Does dose matter in these cases, whether thimerosal-containing vaccines cause autism?
Certainly, when you consider that a child over a short period of time, relatively, it's possible for him or her to get 187 micrograms of mercury. That's a large dose for a child who has a very low body weight. So on a per kilogram basis, my scientific assumption, based on the data I have so far, would be that those amounts of autism, those amounts of thimerosal, could cause autism in some children.
Do you have to get the entire 87.5?
Pardon?
Do you have to get the entire series of shots, the 87.5?
I don't know that. I don't know that. Again, it depends upon the susceptibility of the child and the metabolism of the child as to how he or she handles that mercury. And when you talk about dose determines the poison, as some other people would say, you could also have a child with a small dose or with a large dose having the same effect.
So let's assume that your hypothesis that we have a genetically susceptible child is true. Could 12.5 micrograms cause that child to have autism?
If we knew that, we would be able to do something. But that specific question in a specific child, we don't know the answer to. All we know is there appears to be a relationship between the amount of mercury that children are exposed to via their vaccinations and whether they get autism or not. And you heard what was said this morning by the epidemiologist who quite honestly and carefully debunked many of the epidemiology studies that have been published in the past. It was such a good rendition that I asked him to write a paper just on what he said.
But you don't know the dose it would require.
Pardon?
You don't know the dose of ethylmercury it would require for a child to,
no,
to have autism.
No, I don't think anyone does. Because each child also would be quite different in his response or her response. And there's tremendous variation.
I'll just have about 10 more minutes of questions.
Sure.
Would that be okay?
All right.
Dr. Poshin, you did not speak about this today, but it is contained in your report, and I would like to discuss some of the aspects of your report.
Which, this today's report? Or
the report that you filed for the court that we,
yes,
believed was going to be your testimony today.
Do you think I could have a copy of it?
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
For the record, that's Exhibit 25, I believe.
I think it's Exhibit 19, but I'm not sure.
Dr. Poshin's report?
Report? Yeah.
Oh, okay, Exhibit 19.
Dr. Poshin, on pages 6 and 7 of your report, okay, you discuss four factors that you believe can cause someone to be more susceptible to mercury. Do you have that?
I have a page. I began page 6,
yes.
Number I.
Okay. Do you mean when you say susceptible to mercury toxicity?
Pardon?
When you say susceptible to mercury, do you mean mercury toxicity?
I'm sorry, I can't understand you.
What do you mean by susceptible to mercury?
I don't see the word susceptible at all in this page on page 6. I've looked for it. In the bottom part that's typed, I don't see the word susceptible at all.
Okay, we'll call them then factors of vulnerability.
Where are we?
Well, above that you say many factors. I'll call them, we won't say susceptibility.
Wait, where are you?
I'm on page 6.
All right.
Okay.
Many other factors are involved in the vulnerability.
Okay. I apologize. It was vulnerability, not susceptibility.
Your apology is accepted.
The first of these four factors of vulnerability that you say,
Could you speak into the microphone? Thank you.
The first factor that you say increases someone's vulnerability to mercury. Let's go back. Could you define vulnerability to mercury? What do you mean by that?
You're asking me to define the word vulnerability. Is that
vulnerability
correct?
To mercury.
Yeah.
The phrase that you use. Do you mean mercury toxicity? What do you mean?
I mean their response to mercury. Their vulnerability to mercury would be their response to mercury.
And what would the response to mercury be? Would it be a toxic response?
There's wide variation. In some people, there would be toxic. In some people, there would be high levels of mercury in the blood, or high levels of mercury in the urine, or high levels of mercury in the hair, or some people would have, depending on which species, a tremor. There are all sorts of signs of the vulnerability of an individual to mercury, depending on what the species of mercury is also.
Okay, the first factor you say increases one's vulnerability to mercury is antibiotics. And that's on page 6 of your report.
Yes, antibiotics being used when mercury exposure occurs can inhibit mercury excretion and then potentially increase its toxicity.
And you're referring to the Rowland study, is that correct?
I'm really referring because of, I should have put this down, Ann Summers at the University of, I think it's either University of Georgia or Georgia State, I don't remember. She went there from Mass General where she had a very distinguished career. She has published many papers now that shows that not only exposure to mercury, but the number of amalgams in your mouth can affect the amount of mercury that the antibiotics can affect the amount of mercury you're excreting. And I think that's in good peer-reviewed journals. I want to say Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, but I'm not even sure which journal.
But that's not what you relied on in your report for this.
Again, I'm sorry to bring up a personal matter. This report was written at a time in my life where I could not spend as much time as I usually do. This report was written between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. every morning. And so there are shortcomings. I take that responsibility, and I apologize to the court for it.
Can I just ask you a question? Is the Rowland study that you rely on, is that no longer valid? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there have been more studies since Rowland, namely Ann Sumner's and probably also Fritz Lohscheider. There have been other studies that indicate, that have proven the same thing, that antibiotics will decrease the excretion of mercury.
And you said with dental amalgams.
Pardon?
With dental amalgams?
With or without dental amalgams, wherever the mercury comes from. In many experimental systems, they expose them to mercury vapor, and there have been human studies, I believe, that show the same thing.
Now, the Rowland study was a rat study. Is that correct, a rodent study?
I don't remember the Rowland study now. I think... I would suspect it was a rat study, but I'm not positive.
You don't know the doses of methylmercury that were administered?
Definitely not. There's things like that you can look up and read in the paper. I don't believe in memorizing things like that.
Would you like? We can hand you the paper because
sure.
I do have some questions
sure.
on that.
Do you want this one back, or can I keep this one? Thank you. Now, we're looking at the effects of diet on mercury metabolism and excretion in mice given methylmercury. So it's mice and not rats.
Okay, mice.
Thank you for bringing that to my attention.
On the top of page 402.
402.
And we can highlight that if you don't want to. We can put it right up on the screen.
Okay, I'm on 402, but I don't know what you just said. I'm on page 402.
Dr. Shee has it on the screen for you. If you look at the screen, it may be easier for you.
It was much easier. Thank you.
Would you agree that the dose was 0.6 milligrams of mercury per kilogram?
All right.
And wouldn't this dose of mercury be equivalent to 600 micrograms per kilogram of body weight?
600 micrograms of mercury per kilogram body weight. Is that what you asked? Yes.
And that 600 micrograms per kilogram of body weight would be equal to 6,000 microgram dose in a 10-kilogram child. Is that correct?
Well, they're talking about mice here, and I'm not certain that you can just transpose a mouse dose to a human dose that quickly just by changing the weight. So I don't know what your point is.
My point is the doses are not comparable. Are those doses comparable to the amount of ethylmercury contained in a thimerosal?
I don't claim
vaccine?
The doses are comparable. I don't claim that's so.
But you said in your report that based on the Roland paper, high doses of methylmercury in mice inhibit the excretion.
What page are we on now?
I'm sorry. You said that based on the Roland studies, that high doses of methylmercury, high doses of antibiotics.
What I say is, if you're talking about page 6,
mm-hmm.
Let's quote it correctly. Antibiotics being used when mercury exposure occurs can inhibit mercury excretion and thus potentially increase its toxicity.
Right, but weren't the doses, even with the administration of antibiotics, were not the doses administered to the mice in this study, larger than the doses that are contained?
I make no claim about dosage in this. All I'm saying is, and I quote the Roland paper here, whatever dosage they're using, that antibiotics being used when mercury exposure occurs can inhibit mercury excretion and thus potentially increase its toxicity.
So this study has no applicability to what antibiotics can do to a person who's exposed to thimerosal through a thimerosal-containing vaccine?
I think what you've got to understand is science changes. Sometimes it changes the way you want it to change, other times, whether it's you or me, and sometimes it changes a different way. In this case, these studies showed that mercury excretion was inhibited by giving an antibiotic. Now, I'm on very weak grounds with following statement, all right? I wish I'd known you would ask this. I would have been certain.
It was in
there
your
may
report.
Even be some... Pardon?
It was in your report.
No. Whether it's in my report or not, it doesn't matter. I just didn't realize I had to be prepared for this. What I'm trying to say is there may be a study in humans by Ann Summers in which, I'll make a point of calling her tomorrow. Either Ann or someone else did some studies, I think, showing that when humans were giving antibiotics, that there was a decreased mercury excretion. That statement is usually accepted by most toxicologists today.
Of methylmercury or ethylmercury?
I'm just talking about whatever mercury they were using at the time. I don't remember what... I'm certain they didn't give methylmercury to humans in the experimental situation to prove that. My guess is they gave it to probably normal humans that were ill. They gave them an antibiotic, and they also did a fecal excretion and a urinary excretion of mercury. That's what my guess is. And probably related it to mercury, their mercury exposure. I'm not positive of that, but that's what comes up in the back of my mind.
So you're not sure?
I'm not sure. I'm telling you the truth when I say I'm not certain.
Now, the second factor you list on page 6 of your report, the second factor.
Yes.
You state that a factor may increase one's vulnerability. One factor is a combination of genetic predisposition and a stress, such as fever, may increase the impact of the stress-causing agent. And you cite Morton.
And what's your question?
The Morton article is entitled The Genetic Epidemiology of Hearing Impairment. We can hand you that article if you would like to see it.
Hmm. You brought up a very good point. And I'll go back and see what the story is. It seems ridiculous for me. No abstract available. It's also possible I have that in my library at home.
We have that article.
I can't answer anymore.
We have that article. I have.
Oh, is it in there? Can I see that? Thank you. Is it mentioned? I'll take your word for it. Is it mentioned?
Well, my question to you is, you mentioned the article in your report.
Yeah, but now what I'm asking you is, do they mention stress and mercury in this report?
They make no reference to mercury.
Then my guess is that it was a mistake and it should have been the Mutter paper immediately thereafter. Because the Mutter paper comments on the article, The Toxicology of Mercury and Its Chemical Compounds, or another Mutter. I don't know. You have a good point. I concede that point to you.
So can you cite to a peer-reviewed article on the combination of genetic susceptibility and a stress with regards to thimerosal and autism? So genetic susceptibility, stress, thimerosal leading to autism. Is that the article you felt you did not?
You're talking about number three? Is that what you're talking about?
Right. Can you cite to a peer-reviewed article about a combination of genetic susceptibility, stress, with regard to thimerosal and autism?
And so now what is your question?
Can you cite to a peer-reviewed article? Not you said that Morton doesn't apply in this case, correct?
Doctor, she's still on point two at the bottom of page six.
I'm at that point. And I don't understand what your question is. I can read this.
Okay, if the Morton article doesn't apply, which you just said the Morton article should not have been cited, correct?
You're absolutely correct.
Okay.
I'm certainly not perfect.
Okay. Can you cite, though, to a peer-reviewed paper that discusses the combination of genetic susceptibility and stress with regard to thimerosal causing autism?
I'm not sure that. Let me just check one thing. All these points refer not to autism, but they refer to the accepted the once accepted toxicology axiom that dose determines a poison. Nowhere in that first paragraph on page six, or on the second, or under one or two, do I see the word thimerosal or autism. So I don't understand what the point is, ma'am. I don't mean to be rude. I just don't understand.
Well, sir, you put these in your report about what makes people more vulnerable to mercury. And I just want to go over as to the basis that
I don't say anything about thimerosal, and I don't say anything about autism here.
So these don't apply to thimerosal-containing vaccines?
I don't know that. I'd have to think more about that. Think that these are generally accepted beliefs about the vulnerability of people to mercury.
Right?
That antibiotics are generally now considered to increase to inhibit mercury excretion. And there's certainly many people accept the idea that there's a genetic predisposition to mercury toxicity. I think there are a number, or the effects of mercury, and there are a number of papers that prove that now. So I haven't said anything about thimerosal and autism in these lines that you're quoting.
So the Palmer study,
let's go to the Palmer study. This study has been criticized probably quite well since this paper was published about, I'm not even sure, again, it's been a long time, I'm not even sure they measured the mercury in the air. I just don't remember this paper well enough. If you have that paper, I'd love to have it.
Why did you cite the Palmer study?
Pardon?
Why did you cite the Palmer study?
The Palmer study was cited because, as it says here someplace, the association between environmentally related mercury, special education, and autism rates in Texas was investigated using data from the Texas Education Department and the United States EPA. There was a significant increase in the rates of special education students and autism rates associated with increases in environmentally released mercury. On the average, for each 1,000 pounds of environmental released mercury, there was a 43% increase in the rate of special education services and a 61% increase in the rate of autism. Now, this study has been criticized, and I just, again, it's been so long since I read this article, I don't remember all the criticism, but the study has been criticized, I think, for, I don't remember whether they themselves did the mercury determinations or if any mercury determinations were actually done.
Doctor, is it your opinion that mercury in the air causes autism?
No. But that's not the only exposure that one that a person may have, or a child may have, or a mother, a pregnant woman may have to mercury. It's not just mercury in the air. I think in my slides today, I made it very clear that exposure of humans to mercury in the air is not very important.
The fourth factor that you list in your report
. Let me check the reference source to be certain it's correct. Yes.
Okay, you state
it's
that...
Excellent book, the new Nordberg book, yes.
But the fourth factor you say plays a role in someone's vulnerability to poisons is diet. Is that correct? It's on page 7 of your report?
Yes, one of the points.
And you state... in your report, the glutamine is low in autistic children. Is that correct?
I guess that's what I say.
What studies do you rely on for the proposition that glutamine is, levels are lower in autistic children?
I would suggest, it's not a very good reference, that the new Nordberg text, which is an excellent text that I recommend to anyone who's interested in metals. It was just published in 2007, and there are chapters in there about... glutamine, metals, and autistic children, as I remember. It's a chapter in the Nordberg book. I had not realized before that I did not put the page number down.
Now, you stated on page 7 of your report that glutamine is a precursor of glutathione.
Glutathione is glutamyl cystinyl. Damn, glutamyl cystinyl. Glutamyl cystinyl glycine. I've forgotten the other amino acid. But glutamic acid certainly is part of glutathione.
Is it a direct precursor?
Pardon?
It's not a direct precursor, as you state in your report, is it, sir?
In order to make glutathione, you have to have glutamyl cysteine. It's one of the precursors. In order to make glutamyl cysteine, you have to have glutamic acid.
What's the basis for your opinion on that?
Pardon?
What is the basis for that?
Go to any basic biochemistry textbook.
Well, we're going to pull up the Jill James paper. And that's Jill James 205. It's petitioner's master list 7. And we'll see from the homocysteine down to the glutathione. I don't see glutamine on there. Is glutamine a precursor to glutathione?
But this is not the only way of making glutathione in the cell. I mean, if you look at the structure, you must have someplace the structure, the chemical formula for glutathione. And you'll see glutamyl cystinyl glycine. I think that's what it is. Here we have cystathionine, we have the cysteine, and let's see, acetylcysteine, homocysteine. There are other pathways. This is not the only pathway for making glutathione. If you go to an elementary textbook of medical biochemistry, you'll find 3 or 4 different pathways.
Assuming glutamine levels are low, are glutamine concentrations rate-limiting in glutathione synthesis?
I don't know.
So the concentration in glutamine doesn't determine the synthesis rate of glutathione?
I don't know.
How much lower are the levels of glutathione in autistic children compared to non-autistic children?
Say that again.
How much lower are the levels of glutathione in autistic children compared to non-autistic children?
You have
children?
A copy of the Jill James paper. It's in there.
You don't know off the top of your head? No? Okay,
Jill,
that's fine.
Jill James paper published probably last year or the year before.
Do you know how low levels of glutathione or glutamine have to be in order to inhibit the excretion of 25 micrograms?
I have no idea.
Of ethylmercury?
I have no idea.
Does the body have mechanisms other than glutathione to bind to, transport, and eliminate ethylmercury?
If you read Clarkson's articles, which are good review articles on the whole, I think you'll see that the glutathione is what is considered to be the major pathway. Certainly to get mercury, methylmercury included, into the bile and into the feces, it usually is combined with glutathione as one of the carrier mechanisms.
But
and it may also be combined with glutathione tied up with the protein, but they don't know that yet.
But there are other mechanisms, is
there
that correct?
Other mechanisms.
Could you list some of those mechanisms?
Excuse me?
Could you list a few of the mechanisms?
No.
I'll list some, and if you could tell me if there, am I, if I'm correct. Would selenium be one
what
thing in the
selenium?
Body to, that would help transport, eliminate, and bind to heavy metals such as ethylmercury?
No, you're getting into a very difficult area. Because you've got to ask a specific question. So let me ask a specific question, if I may, that maybe you would like. Does selenium have anything to do with the excretion of mercury? And off the top of my head, I would say no. Does selenium have anything to do with the detoxification of mercury? If you believe most of the people who dabble in this sort of thing, they will say that mercury is very reactive with selenium, and a mercury selenide is formed, as I think I mentioned this in my testimony, and this mercury selenium of mercury selenide is very, very insoluble. I doubt very much, I don't know what the data is, but I doubt very much that mercury selenide comes out in the body as such, because it is so insoluble. Does that answer your question at all? I don't want to make things difficult, I assure you.
That answers my question. I have another question for you.
Right.
Does metallothionine, is that a, something in the body that bind, transports, and eliminates heavy metals such as ethylmercury?
This is, let's first deal with simple mercuric ions, all right? There's no question that mercuric ions have a have an affinity for metallothionine. Metallothionine is a protein of which I think 1/3 of the amino acids are cysteines, CYSH, free sulfhydryl groups. So metallothionine is used in the body as a mechanism, number one, for inactivating cadmium. another mechanism, another metal may be lead, and mercury is certainly, mercuric mercury is one of them. I think methylmercury forms a different complex with metallothionein, and I'm not certain what people feel is the significance of that as far as the excretion. Certainly metallothionein is known to transport certain metals from the liver to the kidney, but whether it does that with mercury, I don't remember. It's not considered to be a major pathway.
I want to move back to glutathione. Does glutathione protect against mercury? Does glutathione only protect against mercury, or does it protect and aid in detoxifying other substances?
Glutathione is one of the concentration of glutathione in your liver cells is 10 millimolar. I mean, that's a lot of glutathione. Tremendous amount of glutathione. It is one of the major detoxifying agents in the body. All right. Does it detoxify other agents? Absolutely. There are not only metals, but many other agents. Glutathione is one of the major endogenous detoxifying agents that we have.
And there's
10 millimolar is no small amount.
It's a huge amount. Is that correct?
It's huge.
So if the levels of glutathione are so low as to cause...
So low,
hypothetically. If your levels of glutathione are so low that you cannot detoxify the amount of ethyl mercury in a mercury-containing vaccine, how could you detoxify any other substance in your body?
Who says the glutathione level is so low that it cannot detoxify things? I don't know. Now, what you must say is a glutathione level in the plasma is very low. You're quoting Jill James, or you're referring to Jill James' work. She did not do liver glutathiones. She did not do brain glutathiones. She did red cell. No, she didn't even do red cell glutathione. She studied plasma glutathione, and as I and everyone else have told her, plasma does not have a high level of glutathione. Most glutathione is an intracellular compound. Very little glutathione is found extracellularly. I don't know whether that helps you or not.
No, it helps me. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think I'll break here for today.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Poggi.
Thank you. You're done for today, but we'll start with you again
tomorrow,
at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
Counsel, before we go off the record, is there anything we should talk about before we break for the day?
Not on the record, sir.
Nothing from petitioners.
Okay. We are done for the record for those for today. For those listening at home, we will start again at the 9 a.m. Eastern time tomorrow morning. Thank you all.